Welcome to Happily Ever After is just the beginning. This is Leslie Dorries. For years, I have talked about sex and intimacy between men and women as the cosmic joke. Men often need the physical act to feel the emotional connection, and women need to feel emotionally connected to open up physically. I've always thought that whoever designed this system had a wicked sense of humor. Trying to match these two seemingly disparate approaches to sex creates a minefield that almost every couple is challenged to navigate. My husband and I aren't immune from this dynamic even after 29 and a half years together. We've had conversations around my difficulty with him randomly touching my body as he walks by and his sharing that most guys would love it if a woman grabbed their junk. We both have a pretty healthy attitude about sex, but I still am amazed by how often he thinks about it. It's not that I don't, but it's nowhere near as often as him. And like many men, he wishes I would initiate intimate activity more. Because it's difficult to get away from your way of experiencing life and sexual desire, there's often a tug of war around how often a couple is intimate, when, and how. Even having a supposedly accessible partner, as in marriage, doesn't ensure a satisfying level of sex and physical intimacy. The reality is that the partner with the lowest level of desire controls the whole sex shebang. To help make sense of why this happens and what a couple can do about it, I am joined by Dr. Barry McCarthy, professor of psychology at American University, therapist, and author of Rekindling Desire. Dr. McCarthy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for asking me, and I really enjoy talking about sexual issues and their role in people's lives and marriages.
And the question I have, because I know that that's a really important thing, but it seems to be a conversation that we have difficulty talking about. So what's your kind of basic approach to introducing the discussion of sex?
Well, what I emphasize when I talk to couples, especially married couples, especially couples that have been together 2 years or longer, is that you want to see sexuality as an intimate team experience, and that both of you need to be on board in terms of saying, we want a relationship that's satisfying, that's secure, and also that's sexual.
I love that. That's great.
Okay. And that when what happens around sexuality, there's a new mantra in the sex therapy field that has not been well translated to the public. And that's the mantra about desire, pleasure, eroticism, and satisfaction. And that rather than splitting it the traditional way, where men are about intercourse and intercourse frequency, and women are about intimacy and affection, what you want is both the man and the woman to value all four dimensions.
And
by far, desire is the most important dimension.
Right, and that seems to be the biggest challenge, and I think it's even getting worse because of lack of time, the distractions that everybody has. I remember being at a conference where one of our colleagues, Pat Love, said her opening was, "What's the biggest challenge for marriage and relationships today?" And we're all kind of, you know, we answers from around the room, and she holds up the smartphone. And it was like, got it.
Right. Easy distractions.
Yeah. And, you know, and you know, people are working a lot. And so what's the impact of that on people's desire level?
Well, here's a key element with desire. Because what facilitates sexual desire is this sense of positive anticipation. The same way you anticipate going to your favorite restaurant, your favorite movie, your favorite athletic event, anticipate touching and being sexual. The second component is where you feel that you deserve for sexuality to be a good part of you and a good part of your relationship, even though everything isn't perfect. You know, the fact that you're overweight, the fact that your child isn't doing well, the fact that your job is boring, you still deserve the pleasure of touching and sexuality. I think the other thing that really feeds desire is this sense of freedom and choice and unpredictability. That's what enhances desire. What subverts desire
So like I said, my husband and I have been together for, you know, going on almost 30 years. So there's a lot of predictability in our lives. I mean, yeah, we're kind of in this great stage now where we're launching our children, so we're kind of back to just being the two of us, which has a great impact. But this whole sense of light, you know, we kind of get into ruts and routines. How do we shake that up?
Well, that's a routine, because one of the things that really hurts desire is where you see sex as a performance and it's very predictable. And what you want to be doing is that you want to redefine what you mean by sexual. So many couples get into the pattern of intercourse or nothing. They have affection, they have intercourse. And if they're going to do any kind of playful or sensual touching, it's an invitation for intercourse. And if they don't want to have intercourse, then they don't do it. And that one of the best things that a couple can do is say, look, we want to value sensual touch, we want to value playful touch, we want to value erotic non-intercourse touch, and we want to value intercourse. That defining sex as intercourse is a big, big mistake. And that's why in the United States, you know, the average intercourse is about 59 to 61 times a year, a little bit over once a week.
Uh-huh.
And the reason for that is this power struggle. And in power struggles, instead of the couple winning and sex winning, it becomes a win-lose kind of situation. That's not inviting.
Well, and I hear what you're saying, because frequently I have experienced this with my clients where almost the only kind of physical interaction is what one party, usually the woman, interprets as, well, this is prelude to sex. It's, you know, so if I let my husband or my partner start touching me, I know where this is going to go. I don't want to go there, so I shut down him touching me at all.
Right. That is the traditional power struggle. And part of that she doesn't want to touch is that if he gets an erection, instead of seeing his erection as a good thing, as something that's inviting, it's seen as, uh-oh, I've got to make sure we have intercourse and he has an orgasm, otherwise there's going to be a big fight.
Well,
that's the power struggle that is really kills desire.
Well, and isn't there some truth to that, though? Because one of the, again, something else I've run into, and I ran into this relatively recently with a couple where he was much more sexually adventuresome than his wife was, and he wanted her to do some things that she wasn't necessarily comfortable with, and, you know, and so he wasn't necessarily satisfied with what she was doing. And one of the things was that he wasn't satisfied with was if they actually did have intercourse and he would have an orgasm and she didn't, that was a real problem for him. Even though that's something that can frequently happen, but...
Well, if you look at happily married couples and who are comfortable with their sexual relationship, that feel good about it, the truth is that less than 50% of their sexual encounters are mutual and synchronous. And what I mean by that is that both people feel desire, both people feel pleasure, they both have orgasms, and they're well bonded and they feel desired and desirable. That's the best kind of sex, but it happens less than 50% of the time. That's really important to understand. The
okay,
other
Dan,
thing
can
that's
you say
really...
that? Can you say that again? Because I really want my listeners to hear that.
Well, I love to repeat myself because I think it really is important. Because again, when people think of what is supposed to happen sexually, it's supposed to be like either an R-rated or X-rated movie. And for 95% of couples, that isn't what's true at all. What couples really want is they want, like the person you just said, he says, I want to have a mutual synchronous sexual experience every time. That is not the reality of couple sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is, if you look at women, again, there's tremendous individual differences in
sure.
this. But that the average woman is orgasmic not 100% of the time. Less than 1 out of 7 women is orgasmic 100% of the time.
Well, that makes me feel better.
The great majority of women can have a variable, flexible orgasmic pattern, and that the average woman who feels really good about sex is orgasmic in 70% of couple sexual experiences.
Okay.
And she might be orgasmic in the pleasuring period, or what used to be called foreplay, but I love the word pleasuring much more.
Yeah.
Or she might be orgasmic during intercourse, or she might be orgasmic during afterplay.
Hmm.
But that notion that says, the new view in sexuality is that female sexuality is first class. It is not second class to male sexuality. It is more individualistic, it is more variable, it is more flexible, but it's first class. And that's true about both desire and orgasm.
And
couples who embrace that.
Something that the,
okay.
I heard you talk about several years ago about using the male model of desire for women.
Right. In the male model that says this is the way you're supposed to have sex.
Uh-huh.
But the male model is it's driven by easy, predictable erections. It's driven by the desire for orgasm. It's driven, basically, the notion that says each sexual experience should end in intercourse. That's not a good model for ongoing couples. It sets up the power struggle.
Mm-hmm.
The notion of female responsive sexual desire is really empowering. That says that often the woman will begin in a kind of neutral state. And as she engages with her partner, not him doing foreplay on her to get her ready for intercourse, that actually is a turnoff. But where they engage together with pleasuring and with connection, when she is feeling starting to get turned on, that's when she experiences desire. Her desire is responsive to the situation rather than orgasm-driven or spontaneously arousal-driven.
Right.
And that's true of most women.
Yeah, that reminds me of a story. I was back when I was, you know, studying to get my degree and stuff. We were going to a conference, and there were four of us, four women spending, you know, sharing a room, and two of us were married and had small children. One was a widow, and the other one was in a long-term relationship. And two of us said that if the answer was not an absolute definite no to engage in sexual activity with our husband, it was a yes, because we would find that, number one, it would be a gift to him, it would be a gift to us, and we often would find that maybe in the beginning we weren't interested, but halfway in, we were having a grand old time.
And that's a responsive desire.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. But I think the thing that is so interesting is that if that's the only way that you and your husband are sexual, it ultimately will decrease desire. That what feeds desire is that sense of playfulness, that sense of unpredictability, and the idea that you have a right, or he has a right, to say, let's make this a sensual date, make it a playful date, or let's do erotic non-intercourse sex that is either mutual or is asynchronous.
I hear what you're saying, but how do we get ourselves out of this mindset that it's okay? And maybe I'm hearing you wrong, but so clarify, help me understand that I'm getting this, that it's okay to have sexual interaction without orgasm either happening or being the end goal. Am I hearing that right?
That's exactly right. That the basic issue sexually is this. Sex is about sharing pleasure. It's not about performing. And it's also the notion that says sexuality is much more than intercourse. You know, one of the things that people don't understand is that when couples give up being sexual, or they just totally stop, and that the operational definition of that is being sexual less than 10 times a year,
right?
It's always the man's decision. In 90% of the cases or more, it's the man's decision. And it's his decision because he's lost his confidence with erections and intercourse. And so he says, if sex isn't predictable, I want to avoid. So
interesting, because I would have thought that it was women because women tend to be, I don't know if there's so much low desire or their desire is different, as you just wonderfully explained.
It's different, and basically the woman feels that she doesn't live up to his model of desire. But that one of the best things that the woman can do for herself and for the relationship is to say to her husband or to say to her partner, I don't want to be one of those statistics. I don't want to be one of five of married couples. One out of five is non-sexual.
Mm-hmm.
And of non-married couples who've been together 2 years or longer, one out of three are non-sexual. Where she says, I don't want to be that way. I want to have a sexuality that is pleasure-oriented and that I feel desired and desirable.
So
and
how
for
do
that
we,
to
how
happen,
do we shift?
We've got to play sexually.
Yeah, how do we shift that societal mindset around what we think is, I mean, I always love it because I get couples to come in and, you know, they'll you know, because I almost always ask about what their intimate life is. I think it's an incredibly important thing for a professional to do.
I agree.
And I always get, well, is this normal? And I have to go, it's like, okay, first off, let's get rid of this normal thing. but how do we shift this mindset from this focus on orgasm?
Again, I'm very much in favor of arousal, intercourse, and orgasm. I want to make that
right.
clear.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it.
But where it becomes a pass-fail performance test, that's where it goes astray.
Okay.
And it can go astray in your 30s or your 40s, but it really goes astray in your 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Interesting.
So when I see couples who are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s, I say to them, especially to the man, do you want to be a wise man and that when you can stay sexual into your 80s, or do you want to be a traditional man and traditional men stop being sexual in their 50s, 60s, or 70s?
Interesting.
And they stop being sexual because they're playing the game by the old rules. And the old rules interfere with healthy couple sexuality. That ultimately sexuality is a couple, it's a team sport, and that the more you turn towards your partner, whether it's mutual or asynchronous, whether it's a good experience or a bad experience, that's what's going to allow you to stay sexual.
Well, I love this, and I just want to remind you that you're listening to Happily Ever After is just the beginning on webtalkradio.net. If you want to know how to reignite your relationship, or if you have a topic you want me to address in a future show, contact me at Leslie, L-E-S-L-I, at foundationscoachingnc.com. And we're having this really interesting conversation with Dr. Barry McCarthy, who is the author of the book Rekindling Desire. And he's really talking about turning everything we know about sex on its head, which I think is wonderful. But how do we get this? I mean, I know that you go out, you give talks, you practice, you have your book, but how do we get society as a whole to know about what you're talking about?
Well, I think the way we get society as a whole to do it is that rather than the traditional men are this way, women are this way, it's always a power struggle,
mm-hmm.
that you look at male-female relationships as equitable relationships. And we're there as when you're looking at adult men and women who've been in a relationship 2 years or longer, there are many more similarities than differences.
Mm-hmm.
And that one of those similarities is what the function of sex is. The function of sex is to allow you to feel desire and desirability. That's the core thing. That the thing that's so interesting about the sex field is that when sex works well in people's lives, it's a relatively small, it's an integral part, but it's relatively small. I like to think about it as a 15 to 20% contribution.
Right.
But when sex is problematic, it's the thing that causes great stress in a relationship and often breaks up relationships.
Right. Because
whether that is dysfunctional sex or fighting about affairs. But the most destructive is where you stop touching and you stop being sexual.
Right, and there's a lot of reasons. I mean, you know, it's interesting. Both of my children actually my daughter is about to enter her last year of being a teenager, and my son is in his 20s, and you know, the idea, you know, their idea of their parents being sexual just is so disgusting to them, they can't even stand it. But we're talking about people, you know, you're talking about people still being active and sexual into their 70s and 80s, which I think
and there's good science behind that. That isn't just a clinical idea. It
right.
was published, the big study was published in New England Journal of Medicine.
So other than desire, this misunderstanding about desire and the purpose and the pleasure of sex, what else gets in the way for couples?
Well, there's many things, but one of the things that you would ask that we talk about is the issue about eroticism generally and pornography specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Eroticism is an integral part of healthy couple sexuality. That's an important message.
And how would you define eroticism?
What eroticism is different than intimacy and pleasuring, but it's not incompatible. Eroticism is all about intense emotional and sexual feelings. It's all about taking risks. It's all about mystery and creativity. It's all about unpredictability. It's all about lustful feelings.
Okay.
Eroticism is a good thing, not a bad thing.
Okay, now, I'm with you.
Now, the big argument around pornography is, does that subvert couple sexuality? And for some people, and some couples, it definitely does. But for not for the majority, that the way to understand pornography is that pornography is all about a fantasy approach to sex. It's not about real life couple sexuality, and that what is destructive with pornography is when it's secret, when it's shameful, and it's a compartmentalized eroticism. That is really destructive.
So, can you explain a little bit more what you mean? The secret part is obviously clear, but what do you mean by compartmentalized?
In other words, compartmentalized means. Let me say it positively first and then problematically.
Okay.
The role of eroticism, including erotic fantasies, erotic materials, is to elicit sexual desire and serve as a bridge to sexual desire and serve as a bridge to high arousal and orgasm. That's its healthy function.
Okay.
The unhealthy function is when, again, the poison's the big three. It's secret. It's highly erotically charged, and it's highly shameful. The more shameful you are about sex, the more it's going to cause pain for you and for the relationship. And pornography is basically about not real. When people say, well, that's what you really want to have in your life, that isn't what people really want to have. You know, the best-selling, I wish I had a book that would sell this, that the Shades of Grey book.
Uh-huh.
It made no sense at all sexually, but it sold at 22 million copies.
Right. Would women really want this kind of a relationship? But
no.
Yeah.
It isn't about real couples and real sexual feeling. It's all about erotic fantasy. Erotic fantasy, what people want in fantasy is totally different than what they want in reality. And that's where the confusion is, where people say, you want me to be like that person in the erotic video. That isn't what the man wants at all.
Let me ask this, because I have talked with a lot of couples about this, and are men aware that that's not what they want? Because pornography has changed. I mean, I was introduced to a pornographic movie at the university that I went to, which was a rather interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's evolved over the years into something that's, you know, more. A lot of times it's more extreme sexual acts or...
Right, it's
or
very
idea
extreme.
That, you know, women in general or men in general would find this particular act pleasurable, or you know,
it isn't about pleasure.
Oh, yeah,
what
no,
it's about
not.
is it's like a We talk about five gears of touch or connection. We talk about affectionate touch, sensual touch, playful touch, erotic touch, and intercourse touch.
Okay.
Pornography is like a supercharged erotic gear. It's like a sixth gear. What it's about for 85% of men and for 95% of women who use pornography, it's all about understanding that this is a fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Does it cause people to get into big trouble and disrupt relationships? It absolutely does. But that's for the minority who do get confused about the role and meaning of pornography. The great majority of both men and women who are in ongoing relationships or married occasionally masturbate.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they use when they masturbate is they use fantasy or they use erotic or porn materials. That's normal. There's nothing unhealthy about it. The unhealthy part, again, is when instead of it being seen as a fantasy, it's that combination of secrecy, eroticism, and shame. That's the unhealthy part, not the porn itself.
Are you seeing any changes with the extraordinary ease with which I'm thinking of young people, maybe 12, 13, mm-hmm. 14 years old, maybe even younger than that. I mean, it's really easy now on the internet to either purposely find it or accidentally find it.
Right. Right.
And are you seeing any difference in how that's shaping people's view of sex, what's healthy sex, what's good in the relationship? I don't know if you've seen that, or if you can.
You know, what's
that?
One of the most interesting examples is about a year and a half ago, I did a workshop in India, and pornography in all over the world, including in India, pornography is very big. And mm-hmm. what occurred in this one case that we were discussing is that the cause of infertility was the man did not understand, because his view of sex was not healthy, it was mm-hmm. tied to this porn image, is the idea that you, in porn, you never ejaculate intravaginally.
Right.
And
that's
why
that
he
could
couldn't
cause problems getting somebody pregnant.
He didn't understand that. So porn is not a healthy sex education model.
Mm-hmm.
That's important. And I'm not being pro-porn. What
right.
I am being is this notion of how you integrate eroticism into intimacy, pleasuring, and satisfaction.
Right, and pornography is one way to do it. I remember I wrote I ended up writing a blog post several years ago because I'd had several of my male clients telling me how much they hated chick flicks, and my kind of off the cuff response to that was, well, do you like sex? Because a lot of times if you spend, 90 minutes watching a romantic movie, it changes the desire level. And I think, and I think a healthy use of porn can do the same. Like you said, it's supercharged.
Right. But, one of the fights that couples get into, I hear this over and over again, is the woman says, I can't be like the woman in the porn video. That she feels intimidated by the woman in the porn video, where in fact, he doesn't want to have sex with the woman in the porn video. He wants to have sex with his partner. But that the porn video for him is a bridge to feel more turned on.
But it's not for her, necessarily.
No, when it goes healthily, when it's the bridge, it gets them more turned on with each other when they're together. So that one of the big fights between the traditional marriage people and the sex people is that the marriage people basically say porn is going to destroy people's lives and destroy marriages.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly can, but only when it's misused. And that the big issue with eroticism, and again, porn is not even the best example of eroticism, because the majority of couples, in so many self-help blogs and things on the internet, there's this notion that says You can spice up your sex life by acting out a porn video. When people try to do that, or they act out their erotic fantasy, you know what the most typical result is? Is it's a bomb.
Yeah, I would think it would be.
It feels self-conscious. It isn't fun at all.
Yeah.
What works in fantasy is not what works in reality. And for the great majority of couples, that they do not use porn with each other. What they do with each other is what is called partner interaction arousal, which is that the most arousing thing is where your partner is open and responsive to you and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And as couples age, one of the things that they do is they use much more what is called self-entrancement arousal. In other words, taking turns. And at the receiving partners, whether it's the man or the woman, is able to just lay back and really take in feelings and sensations. And that the giving partner becomes aroused by the receiving partner's arousal. That's much more common in terms of what is erotic in relationships.
Well, and I like that you said that, because it's, you know, because that is really the way, you know, the way it works is if we're open to that and if we're mature enough, you know, to recognize that that's the way it can be. Can you please, one of the things before we wrap up I would really like is for you to let our listeners, my listeners, know, where can they get more information on how to have better sex, how to have a better erotic life?
You know, in my view, the best of all the books, especially for people that have been together 5-10 years, is a book that was written by my colleague, Michael Metz. I'm the second author, but Michael, it's the last book he wrote before he died. It's called Enduring Desire, about how you keep healthy sexuality alive in an ongoing relationship. And that's true whether it's a married relationship or a life partnership.
Right, right.
And I think the thing that's important is not just reading it by yourself, but reading it with your partner and marking up things that you think are particularly relevant to you,
mm-hmm.
and discussing that. But the most important thing is this idea of actually having a date where you say to each other, let's have a sensual date and just make it sensual.
Right.
Or let's have an erotic date where there's a prohibition on intercourse.
Right.
Or let's try a playful date and see what happens.
Right. Yeah, let's just have fun. I always tell my couples, it's like, you know, if you're spending time together and, you know, many people have sex in their bedrooms. It's like, well, you know, go to bed at the same time. Nothing might happen, but who knows? You might end up having a whole lot of fun. And I really want my listeners to understand that, you know, just because you and your partner have a different level of sexual desire doesn't mean you have to settle for less than enjoyable sex life. And Dr. McCarthy, I think you've given us some wonderful information and really reinforced for me that one advantage to being with the same person for years is that you really get the opportunity to know who they are, to know what they find desirable. You guys get to create this opportunity to learn about each other. But, of course, we have to be willing to acknowledge, you know, that this takes time and it takes a certain level of openness and adventure.
And it also takes a certain level where one of the best measures of healthy sexuality is when you and your spouse or your partner have a mediocre or unsatisfying or dysfunctional experience, instead of avoiding each other or blaming, that you are able to laugh it off or at least shrug it off and say, let's get together in the next 1, 2, 3 days so we can have a good experience.
And I so love that. But again, we have to let go of that fear. And I'm always thinking, you know, if you can laugh, you're halfway there. But sex is so personal that sometimes it's really, really hard to do that.
I think it's a challenge, but I think that in terms of this idea of desire and desirability, that people who look at sex as a performance, that they only feel loved and accepted when everything is perfect. That's bad for couple sex lives.
I think it's bad for anybody's life, well, sex or otherwise.
I agree.
Well, Dr. McCarthy, thank you so much for joining me today. We could continue this conversation, and hopefully we will be able to in the future, because I would really love to help you get out there and give people, you know, a different way of looking at sex and explaining how to make it better. But you're listening to Happily Ever After is Just the Beginning. This is Leslie Dorries, and until next week, stay loving.